Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 219th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm Felbrig. Today we're starting off with the next part of Mr. Standfast, where we'll actually hear the title character mentioned. And then we'll have a musical number, and then back for more of the Ghost Pirates. Let's get started. Chapter 15, Part 2. That night I cooked our modest dinner, and we smoked our pipes with the stove door open and a good smell of wood smoke in our nostrils. I told him of all my doings, and of the wild birds and ivory, and the job we were engaged on. Blenkeron's instructions were that we too should live humbly and keep our eyes and our ears open, for we were outside of suspicion. The cantankerous lame boar and his loutish servant from Erosia. Somewhere in the place was a rendezvous of our enemies, and thither came Chelius on his dark errands. Peter nodded his head sagely. I think I've guessed the place. The daughter of the old woman used to pull my chair sometimes down to the village, and I've sat in cheap inns and talked to servants. There's a fresh water pan there. It's all covered with snow now, and beside it, there's a big house that they call the Pink Chalet. I do not know much about it, except that rich folk live in it, for I know the other houses, and they're harmless. Also the big hotels, which are too cold and public for strangers to meet in. I put Peter to bed, and it was a joy to me to look after him, to give him his tonic and prepare the hot water bottle that comforted his neuralgia. His behaviour was like a docile child's, and he never lapsed from his sunny temper, though I could see how his leg gave him hell. They had tried massage for it and given it up, and there was nothing for him but to endure until nature and his tough constitution deadened the tortured nerves again. I shifted my bed out of the pantry and slept in the room with him, and when I woke in the night, as one does the first time in a strange place, I could tell by his breathing that he was wakeful and suffering. Next day, a bath chair containing a grizzled cripple and pushed by a limping peasant might have been seen descending the long hill to the village. It was clear, frosty weather, which makes the cheeks tingle, and I felt so full of beans that it was hard to remember my game leg. The valley was shut in on the east by a great mass of rocks and glaciers, belonging to a mountain whose top could not be seen. But on the south, above the snowy firwoods, there was a most delicate lace-like peak, with a point like a needle. I looked at it with interest, for beyond it lay the valley which led to the Storb Pass, and beyond that was Italy, and Mary. The old village of St. Anton had one long narrow street which bent at right angles to a bridge which spanned the river flowing from the lake. Thence the road climbed steeply, but at the other end of the street it ran on the level by the water's edge, lined with gimcrack boarding houses, now shuttered to the world, and a few villas in patches of garden. At the far end, just before it plunged into the pine wood, a promontory jutted into the lake, leaving a broad space between the road and the water. Here were the grounds of a more considerable dwelling. Snow-covered laurels and rhododendrons with one or two bigger trees, and just on the water's edge stood the house itself, called the Pink Chalet. I wheeled Peter past the entrance on the crackling snow of the highway. Seen through the gaps of the trees, the front looked new, but the back part seemed to be of some age, for I could see high walls broken by few windows hanging over the water. The place was no more a chalet than a donjon, but I suppose the name was given in honour of a wooden gallery above the front door. The whole thing was washed in an ugly pink. There were outhouses, garage or stables amongst the trees, and at the entrance there were fairly recent tracks of an automobile. On our way back we had some very bad beer in a cafe and made friends with the woman who kept it. Peter had to tell her his story, and I trotted out my aunt in Zurich, and in the end we heard her grievances. She was a true Swiss, angry at all the belligerents who had spoiled her livelihood, hating Germany most but also fearing her most. Coffee, tea, fuel, bread, even milk and cheese were hard to get, and cost a ransom. It would take the land years to recover, and there would be no more tourists, for there was little money left in the world. I dropped a question about the Pink Chalet and was told that it belonged to one Schwiegler, a professor of Bern, an old man who came sometimes for a few days in the summer. It was often let, but not now. Asked if it was occupied, she remarked that some friends of the Schwieglers, rich people from Basel, had been there for the winter. "They come and go in great cars," she said bitterly, "and they bring their food from the cities. They spend no money in this poor place." Presently, Peter and I fell into a routine of life, as if we'd always kept house together. In the morning, he went abroad in his chair. In the afternoon, I would hobble about on my own errands. We sank into the background and took its colour, and a less conspicuous pair never faced the eye of suspicion. Once a week, a young Swiss officer, whose business it was to look after British wounded, paid us a hurried visit. I looked to get letters from my aunt in Zurich, sometimes with the postmark of Arosa, and now and then these letters would contain curiously worded advice, or instructions from him whom my aunt called the kind patron. Generally, I was told to be patient. Sometimes I had a word about the health of my little cousin across the mountains. Once I was bidden to expect a friend of the patron's, a wise doctor of whom he had often spoken, but though after that I shadowed the Pink Chalet for 2 days and no doctor appeared. My investigations were a barren business. I used to go down to the village in the afternoon and sit in an out-of-the-way cafe, talking slow German with peasants and hotel porters. But there was little to learn. I knew all there was to hear about the Pink Chalet, and that was nothing. A young man who skied stayed for 3 nights and spent 2 days on the Alps above the Firwoods. A party of 4, including 2 women, was reported to have been there for a night, all ramifications of the rich family of Basel. I studied the house from the lake, which should have been nicely swept into ice rinks, but from lack of visitors was a heap of blown snow. The high old walls of the back part were built straight from the water's edge. I remember I tried a shortcut through the grounds to the high road and was given good afternoon by a smiling German manservant. One way and another, I gathered there were a good many serving men about the place, too many for the infrequent guests, but beyond this I discovered nothing. Not that I was bored, for I'd always Peter to turn to. He was thinking a lot about South Africa, and the thing he liked best was to go over with me every detail of our old expeditions. They belonged to a life which he could think about without pain, whereas the war was too near and bitter for him. He liked to hobble out of doors after darkness came, and look at his old friends, the stars. He called them by the words they use on the veld, and the first star of morning he called the Vuluper, the little boy who inspans the oxen. A name I had not heard for nearly 20 years. Many a great yarn we spun in the long evenings, but I always went to bed with a sore heart. The longing in his eyes was too urgent, longing not for the old days or far countries, but for the health and strength which had once been his pride. One night I told him about Mary. "She will be a happy missy," he said, "but you will need to be very clever with her. For women are queer cattle, and you and I don't know their ways. They tell me English women do not cook and make clothes like our vrouws. So what will she find to do? I doubt an idle woman will be like a merely fed horse." It was no good explaining to him the kind of girl Mary was, for that was a world entirely beyond his ken. But I could see that he felt lonelier than ever at my news. So I told him of the house that I meant to have in England when the war was over. An old house in a green hilly country, with fields that would carry 4 head of cattle to the Morgan, and furrows of clean water, and orchards of plums and apples. "And you will stay with us all the time," I said. "You will have your own rooms and your own boy to look after you, and you will help me to farm, and we'll catch fish together, and shoot the wild ducks when they come up from the pans in the evening. I've found a better countryside than the Houtbosch where you and I plan to have a farm. It is a blessed, happy place, England." He shook his head. "You are a kind man, Dick, but your pretty missy won't want an ugly old fellow like me hobbling about her house. I do not think I'll go back to Africa, for I should be sad there in the sun. I will find a place, a little place, in England, and some day I will visit you, old friend." That night his stoicism seemed for the first time to fail him. He was silent for a long time and went to early bed, where I can vouch for it that he did not sleep. But he must have thought a lot in that time, for in the morning he'd got himself in hand and was as cheerful as a sandboy. I watched his philosophy with amazement. He was far beyond anything I could have compassed myself. He was so frail and so poor, for he'd never had anything in the world but his bodily fitness, and he'd lost that now. And remember, he had lost it after some months of glittering happiness, for in the air he had found the element for which he had been born. Sometimes he dropped a hint that those days when he lived in the clouds and invented a new kind of battle, and his voice always grew hoarse. I could see that he ached with longing for their return, and yet he never had a word of complaint. That was the ritual he had set himself, his point of honour, and he faced the future with the same kind of courage as that with which he had tackled a wild beast or lench himself, only it needed a far bigger brand of fortitude. Another thing was that he had found religion. I doubt if that is the right way to put it, for he'd always had it. Men who live in the wilds know they are in the hands of God. But his old kind had been a tattered thing, more like heathen superstition, though it had always kept him humble. But now he'd taken to reading the Bible, and to thinking in his lonely nights, and he'd got a creed of his own. I dare say it was crude enough. I'm sure it was unorthodox. But if the proof of religion is that it gives a man a prop in bad days, then Peter's was the real thing. He used to ferret about in the Bible and the Pilgrim's Progress, they were both equally inspired in his eyes, and find texts that he interpreted in his own way to meet his case. He took everything quite literally. What happened 3,000 years ago in Palestine might, for all he minded, have been going on next door. I used to chaff him and tell him that he was like the Kaiser, very good at fitting the Bible to his own purpose. But his sincerity was so complete that he only smiled. I remember one night when he'd been thinking about his flying days, he found a passage in Thessalonians about the dead rising to meet their Lord in the air, and that cheered him a lot. Peter, I could see, had the notion that his time here wouldn't be very long, and he liked to think that when he got his release, he would find once more the old rapture. Once, when I said something about his patience, he said he'd got to try and live up to Mr. Standfast. He'd fixed on that character to follow, though he would have preferred Mr. Valiant for Truth if he'd thought himself good enough. He used to talk about Mr. Standfast in his queer way, as if he were a friend of us both, like Blenkeron. I tell you, I was humbled out of all my pride by the sight of Peter, so uncomplaining and gentle and wise. The Almighty himself couldn't have made a prig out of him, and he never would have thought of preaching. Only once did he give me advice. I'd always a liking for shortcuts, and I was getting a bit restive under the long inaction. One day, when I expressed my feelings on the matter, Peter upped and read from the Pilgrim's Progress. "Some also have wished that the next way to their father's house were here, that they might be troubled no more with either hills or mountains to go over. But the way is the way, and there is no end." All the same, when we got into March and nothing happened, I grew pretty anxious. Blenkeron had said we were fighting against time, and here were the weeks slipping away. His letters came occasionally, always in the shape of communications from my aunt. One told me that I would soon be out of a job, for Peter's repatriation was just through, and he might get his movement order any day. Another spoke of my little cousin over the hills, and said that she had hoped to be going to a place called Santa Chiara in the Val Salusiana. I got out the map in a hurry and measured the distance from there to Saint Anton, and pored over the two roads thither, the short one by the Straub Pass, and the long one by the Margiliana. These letters made me think that things were nearing a climax, but still no instructions came. I had nothing to report in my own messages. I'd discovered nothing in the Pink Chalet but idle servants. I was not even sure if the Pink Chalet were not a harmless villa, and I hadn't come within 1,000 miles of finding Chelius. All my desire to imitate Peter's stoicism didn't prevent me from getting occasionally rattled and despondent. The one thing I could do was to keep fit, for I had a notion I might soon want all my bodily strength. I had to keep up my pretense of lameness in the daytime, so I used to take my exercise at night. I would sleep in the afternoon when Peter had his siesta, and then about 10 in the evening after putting him to bed, I would slip out of doors and go for a 4 or 5 hours tramp. Wonderful were those midnight wanderings. I pushed up through the snow-laden pines to the ridges where the snow lay in great wreaths and scallops, until I stood on the crest with a frozen world at my feet, and above me a host of glittering stars. Once on a night of full moon, I reached the glacier at the valley head, scrambled up the moraine to where the ice began, and peered fearfully into the spectral crevasses. At such hours, I had the earth to myself, for there was not a sound except the slipping of a burden of snow from the trees, or the crack and the rustle which reminded me that a glacier was a moving river. The war seemed very far away, and I felt the littleness of our human struggles, until I thought of Peter turning from side to side to find ease in the cottage far below me. Then I realized that the spirit of man was the greatest thing in this spacious world. I would get back about 3 or 4, have a bath in water which had been warming in my absence, and creep into bed, almost ashamed of having 2 sound legs, when a better man a yard away had but 1. Oddly enough, at these hours there seemed more life in the pink chalet than by day. Once, tramping across the lake long after midnight, I saw lights in the lake front in windows which for ordinarily were blank and shuttered. Several times I cut across the grounds when the moon was dark. On one such occasion a great car with no lights swept up the drive, and I heard low voices at the door. Another time a man ran hastily past me and entered the house by a little door on the eastern side, which I had not before noticed. Slowly the conviction began to grow on me that we were not wrong in marking down this place. The things went on within it which it deeply concerned us to discover. But I was puzzled to think of a way. I might butt inside, but for all I knew, it would be upsetting Blenkiron's plans, for he'd given me no instructions about housebreaking. All this unsettled me worse than ever. I began to lie awake, planning some means of entrance. I would be a peasant from the next valley who had twisted his ankle. I would go seeking an imaginary cousin amongst the servants. I would start a fire in the place, and have the doors flung open to zealous neighbours. And then suddenly I got instructions in a letter from Blenkiron. It came inside a parcel of warm socks that arrived from my kind aunt. But the letter for me was not from her. It was in Blenkiron's large sprawling hand, and the style of it was all his own. He told me that he had about finished his job. He'd got his line on Chelius, who was the bird he expected, and that bird would soon wing its way southward across the mountains for the reason I knew of. "We've got an almighty move on," he wrote, "and please God you're going to hustle some in the next week. It's going better than I ever hoped." But something was still to be done. He'd struck a countryman, one Clarence Don, a journalist of Kansas City, whom he'd taken into the business. Him he described as a crackerjack, and commanded to my esteem. He was coming to St. Anton, for there was a game afoot at the Pink Chalet, which he would give me news of. I was to meet him next evening at 9:15 on the little door in the east end of the house. "For the love of Mike, Dick," he concluded, "be on time and do everything Clarence tells you as if he was me. It's a mighty complex affair, but you and he have sand enough to pull through. Don't worry about your little cousin. She's safe and out of the job for now." My first feeling was one of immense relief, especially at the last words. I read the letter 12 times to make sure I had its meaning. A flash of suspicion crossed my mind that it might be a fake, principally because there was no mention of Peter, who had figured large in the other missives. But why should Peter be mentioned when he wasn't on in this piece? The signature convinced me. Ordinarily, Blenkiron signed himself in full with a fine commercial flourish. But when I was at the front, he'd got into the habit of marking a kind of hieroglyphic of his surname to me and sticking JS after it in a bracket. That was how this letter was signed, and it was sure proof it was all right. I spent that day and the next in wild spirits. Peter spotted what was on, though I did not tell him for fear of making him envious. I had to be extra kind to him, for I could see that he ached to have a hand in the business. Indeed, he asked shyly if I couldn't fit him in, and I had to lie about it, and say it was only another of my aimless circumnavigations of the Pink Chalet. "Try and find something where I can help," he pleaded. "I'm strong enough still, though I'm lame, and I can shoot a bit." I declared that he would be used in time, that Blenkeron had promised he would be used, but for the life of me I couldn't see how. At 9 o'clock on the evening appointed, I was on the lake opposite the house, close in under the shore, making my way to the rendezvous. It was a coal black night, for though the air was clear, the stars were shining with little light, and the moon had not yet risen. With a premonition that I might be long away from food, I'd brought some slabs of chocolate, and my pistol and torch were in my pocket. It was bitter cold, but I'd ceased to mind the weather, and I wore my one suit and no overcoat. The house was like a tomb for silence. There was no crack of light anywhere, and none of the smells of smoke and food which proclaim habitation. It was an eerie job, scrambling up to the steep bank east of the place, to where the flat of the garden started, in a darkness so great that I had to grope my way like a blind man. I found the little door by feeling along the edge of the building. Then I stepped into an adjacent clump of laurels to wait my companion. He was there before me. "Say," I heard a rich Middle West voice whisper, "are you Joseph Zimmer? I'm not shouting any names, but I guess you're the guy I was told to meet here." "Mr. Don?" I whispered back. "The same," he replied. "Shake." I gripped a gloved hand, which drew me back towards the door. Today's music is "I Can't Give You Anything But Love" by Louis Armstrong. Ah, thank you, Louis. And now it's time for the next part of William Hope Hodgson's The Ghost Pirates. Chapter 2. What Tammy the Prentice Saw. The next morning, in my watch below, I had a look at the places where that strange thing had come aboard and left the ship. I found nothing unusual, and no clue to help me to understand the mystery of the strange man. For several days after that, all went quietly, though I prowled about the decks at night, trying to discover anything fresh that might tend to throw some light on the matter. I was careful to say nothing to anyone about the thing I had seen. In any case, I felt sure I should have only been laughed at. Several nights passed away in this manner, and I was no nearer to understanding the affair. And then in the middle watch, something happened. It was my wheel. Tammy, one of the first voyage prentices, was keeping time, walking up and down the lee side of the poop. The second mate was forward, leaning over the break of the poop, smoking. The weather still continued fine, and the moon, though declining, was sufficiently powerful to make every detail about the poop stand out distinctly. Three bells had gone, and I'll admit I was feeling sleepy. Indeed, I believe I must have dozed, for the old packet steered very easily, and there was precious little to do beyond giving her an odd spoke now and then. And then, all at once, it seemed to me that I heard someone calling my name, softly. I could not be certain, and first I glanced forward to where the second stood, smoking, and from him I looked into the binnacle. The ship's head was right on her course, and I felt easier. Then suddenly I heard it again. There was no doubt about it this time, and I glanced to leeward. There I saw Tammy reaching over the steering gear, his hand out in the act of trying to touch my arm. I was about to ask him what the devil he wanted, when he held up his finger for silence and pointed forward along the lee side of the poop. In the dim light, his face showed palely, and he seemed much agitated. For a few seconds I stared in the direction he indicated, but could see nothing. "What is it?" I asked in an undertone, after a couple of moments' further ineffectual peering. "I can't see anything." "Shh," he muttered, hoarsely, without looking in my direction. And then all at once, with a quick little gasp, he sprang across the wheelbox and stood beside me trembling. His gaze appeared to follow the movements of something I could not see. I must say that I was startled. His movement had shown terror, and the way he stared to leeward made me think he saw something uncanny. "What the deuce is up with you?" I asked sharply, and then I remembered the second mate. I glanced forward to where he lounged. His back was still towards us, and he had not seen Tammy. Then I turned to the boy. "For goodness sake, get to leeward before the second sees you," I said. "If you want to say something, say it across the wheelbox. You've been dreaming." Even as I spoke, the little beggar caught at my sleeve with one hand, and pointing across the log reel to the other, screamed, "He's coming! He's coming!" At this instant the second mate was running aft, singing out to know what was the matter. Then suddenly, crouching under the rail near the log reel, I saw something that looked like a man, but so hazy and unreal that I could scarcely say I saw anything. Yet like a flash my thoughts ripped back to the silent figure I had seen in the flicker of the moonlight a week earlier. The second mate reached me, and I pointed dumbly, and yet as I did so, it was with the knowledge that he would not be able to see what I saw. Queer, wasn't it? And then, almost in a breath, I lost sight of the thing, and became aware that Tammy was hugging my knees. The second continued to stare at the log reel for a brief instant, and then he turned to me with a sneer. "Been asleep, the pair of you, I suppose." Then, without waiting for my denial, he told Tammy to go to hell out of it and stop his noise, or he'd boot him off the poop. After that, he walked forward to the break of the poop and lit his pipe again, walking forward and aft every few minutes and eyeing me at times, I thought with a strange half-doubtful, half-puzzled look. Later, as soon as I was relieved, I hurried down to the prentice's berth. I was anxious to speak to Tammy. There were a dozen questions that worried me, and I was in doubt what I ought to do. I found him crouched on a sea chest, his knees up to his chin, and his gaze fixed on the doorway with a frightened stare. I put my head into the berth, and he gave a gasp. Then he saw who it was, and his face relaxed something of its strained expression. He said, "Come in a low whisper, which he tried to steady, and I stepped over the washboard and sat down on a chest facing him. "What was it?" he asked, putting his feet down onto the deck and leaning forwards. "For God's sake, tell me what it was." His voice had risen, and I put up my hand to warn him. "Hush," I said. "You'll wake the other fellows." He repeated his question, but in a lower tone. I hesitated before answering him. I felt all at once that it might be better to deny all knowledge, to say I hadn't seen anything unusual. I thought quickly, and made answer on the turn of the moment. "What was what?" I said. "That's just the thing I've come to ask you. Pretty pair of fools you made the two of us up on the poop just now, with your hysterical tomfoolery." I concluded my remark in a tone of anger. "I didn't," he answered, in a passionate whisper. "You know I didn't, you know. You saw it yourself. You pointed it out to the second mate. I saw you." The little beggar was nearly crying between fear and vexation at my assumed unbelief. "Rot," I replied. "You know jolly well you were sleeping in your timekeeping. You dreamed something and woke up suddenly. You were off your chump." I was determined to reassure him, if possible. Though, goodness, I wanted to assure myself. If he had known of that other thing I'd seen down on the main deck, what then? "I wasn't asleep any more than you were," he said bitterly. "And you know it. You're just fooling me. The ship's haunted." "What?" I said sharply. "She's haunted," he said again. "She's haunted." "Who says so?" I inquired in a tone of unbelief. "I do. And you know it. Everybody knows it. But they don't more than half believe it. I didn't until tonight." "Damned rot," I answered. "That's all a blooming old shellback's yarn. She's no more haunted than I am." "It's not damned rot," he replied, totally unconvinced. "And it's not an old shellback's yarn. Why won't you say you saw it?" he cried, growing almost tearfully excited and raising his voice again. I warned him not to wake the sleepers. "Why won't you say you saw it?" he repeated. I got up from the chest and went towards the door. "You're a young idiot," I said, "and I should advise you not to go gassing like this around the decks. Take my tip. Turn in. Get a sleep. You're talking dotty. Tomorrow you'll perhaps feel what an unholy ass you've made of yourself." I stepped over the washboard and left him. I believe he followed me to the door to say something further, but I was halfway forward by then. The next couple of days I avoided him as much as possible, taking care never to let him catch me alone. I was determined, if possible, to convince him that he'd been mistaken in supposing that he'd seen anything that night. Yet after all, it was little enough use, as you will soon see. For on the night of the second day, there was a further extraordinary development that made denial on my part useless. That's all for today. Except to mention that my reading of The Time Machine by H.G. Wells is available as an audiobook from Audible, along with about another 70 or so of my audiobooks. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution non-commercial no derivatives license. So, until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk